Good morning. I have something very embarrassing to confess. Please don't discuss it with anybody outside of this room. But this morning when I went out to get in my car, I'd gotten almost out of the driveway when I realized that it was Pledge Week on NPR. And I went back into the house and picked up a stack of CDs that I can listen to in the car this week so I don't have to be continually harassed for money. I did make my pledge. I do it without guilt, but I don't want anybody to know that I've blocked this out. But now with you all as a captive audience, I'm going to make the same pitch to you all. This is the time of year when the Miller Center, frankly, receives something over half of its annual support from the community. We do not have government funding, as you know. We are dependent on the generosity of our friends for these programs. And lots of people find this a convenient time of year as they're getting ready to close out their tax deductible gifts for the year. So without beating anybody about the head on this, let me please ask that you think of the Miller Center at this time of year as you're doing your year-end gift planning. We depend upon your contributions in order to continue to bring the high level of programs that we think the community enjoys. And that's all I'll say about it. On November 4th, a little bit less than a month from now, we're going to have a very important event here in this room. 15 years ago, President George H.W. Bush convened all 50 governors at the University of Virginia for a domestic summit on education. And out of that summit came an agreement between the governors and the president that really changed the course of federal participation in K-12 education. So what we're doing is having a conference to evaluate how well the promise of the 1989 summit has been realized. Three people since 1990 have held the office of Secretary of Education. Lamar Alexander, who is now senator from Tennessee, became Secretary of Education soon after the 1989 conference for President Bush. Richard Riley, former governor of South Carolina, was Clinton's Secretary of Education, and now Rod Page is Secretary of Education in the George W. Bush administration. All three of them will be here in this room on the afternoon of November 4th to evaluate the progress that has been made. It'll be a great opportunity to hear from the three people who've been in sort of the critical position what sort of progress our country is making in educating our young people. In addition, there'll be some other speakers, Governor Mark Warner, our governor, who is serving this year as chairman of the National Governors Association, will speak late in the afternoon, sort of summarizing the views of the governors. So it'll be a great opportunity to delve into an important issue, and I hope that all of you will come for either all or some part. If you can only come for an hour, there's only one of the speakers you want to hear, we'd love to have you for that. So please put November 4th on your calendars. It was very exciting to learn yesterday, and of course there's been a lot of press today, that the report of the 9/11 Commission has been selected as a finalist for the National Book Award. In his characteristic modesty, Philip Zelikow disclaims responsibility for credit for being the final author of that, but I think that if pressed, he will admit that most of it went in one form or another through his word processor. The elegance with which it's written, the meticulousness with which it is researched, the driving nature of the narrative, the soundness of the conclusions, all bear the hallmarks of Philip Zelikow's remarkable intellect. Philip was here about a month ago to talk about events leading up to 9/11, and today he is going to complete his presentation by discussing for us the events after 9/11, the road from 9/11, including the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. It's a great pleasure to welcome and introduce Dr. Philip Zelikow.
Thank you very much, George. I'd like to begin, first of all, by offering a plug for the Education Summit event that George mentioned. My one and only foray into elective politics was when I was living in Massachusetts, and I ran for and actually won office, defeating an incumbent, to be elected to my town's school board, and served actually on the school board and only resigned from it when I moved from Massachusetts to Virginia to accept my position here. And it's just simply to show that lots of people are interested in education policy, even unlikely people. And for those of you who didn't really think it, who don't really think of education policy as something that sounds all that interesting, I guarantee you if you'll just sit in on a discussion of it for about 15 minutes, you will find yourself interested in it. Opinions will surge to the surface. And you'll realize that actually it's a pretty gripping subject, even if your kids are long out of school. All right. What I'd like to talk about today in this forum is really the second part of a two-part presentation. Many of you heard the first part, which was the road to 9/11. It was the historical side of the report. The large majority of the report is devoted to the road to 9/11 because we had this primary duty to get that factual record straight, and that's very important. The second part that I left for this forum, as I promised then, is the road from 9/11. The bridge between past to present and onward into the future. This is perhaps today the number one issue in American presidential politics. Which president can make our country safer against the threat that both candidates recognize as the number one threat confronting the country? So what I'd like to do today is talk about how the commission approached that problem. The commission spent relatively little time in the report writing about that. When you write about these sorts of policy issues, it very quickly becomes wonkish. It doesn't have a narrative drive, and so it's harder to write about it in an interesting way. People are interested in the bottom lines and the recommendations, but then when they get into the details about government organization, their interest rapidly diminishes. So we spent relatively little time on it, enough really to try to help set an agenda for action. And I think I can report that that agenda for action has been taken up about as vigorously as anyone thought possible, and more vigorously than most thought possible, by both the President and the Congress. And I'll be glad to come back to that both at the end and also in answering your questions about the status of those efforts. But now I want to turn back to the road from 9/11. The Commission basically divided its recommendations for the future into two parts: what to do, and how to do it. What to do amounts to a global strategy, the substance of what we should be doing. And the second part, the how to do it part, is how should we reorganize our government so that we actually have institutions capable of carrying out such an ambitious strategy? The press has given 95% of its attention to the government reorganization issues. Really with the exception of a few outstanding columns by David Sanger and David Brooks in the New York Times and Fareed Zakaria in Newsweek and the syndicated and the folks that carry his syndicated column, there has been really very little notice given to the strategy parts of the commission recommendation, even though they were the first half of our recommendations. In other words, we weren't all about process. Actually, we put substance first, but that's not reflected in the coverage of the commission report. And it's substance where I want to begin. I'm going to divide my talk today into substance and then process. And let me start with substance with an introduction and then three points. The introduction is about a generational challenge, And then the 3 points are the 3 pillars of the global strategy we recommended: attack terrorists and their organizations, prevent the continued growth of Islamist terrorism, and protect against and prepare for terrorist attacks. In other words, offense, prevention, defense. All right. First, though, that introduction about a generational challenge. I'd like you to think a little bit and reflect about the period of history we're in now, the historical moment we're in. Since 9/11, general federal spending on national security, broadly defined, everything that might fall under national and homeland security, has increased in constant dollars from about $350 billion before 9/11 to today approaching $550 billion. So that's an increase of well over 50% in federal spending on national security in 3 years. That's an enormous surge. We fancy academics call that a mobilization of resources. When was the last, you could ask, when was the last time that happened in American history? A comparable surge, a comparable spike on the graph in national security spending. You would have to go back to the Korean War, to the period between 1950, especially the period between 50 and 53. And actually what happened in the Korean War, this is, the Cold War was already evident to many Americans intellectually. And some efforts were being made to address the Cold War. But it hadn't caused any sort of major mobilization or surge in national security spending. Budgets remained relatively modest. The size of the federal government itself, while much larger than it had been, was still relatively modest. Indeed, it was not even so much the outbreak of the Korean War that triggered the surge. That began it. What really gave it enormous momentum was the entry of China into the war late in 1950. And then Americans really began to sense that they were on the verge of World War III. And they went through a mobilization akin to what they had done between about 1940 and 1944. And national security spending enormously surged. Some of you will remember that's also when the reserves started getting called up. A lot of you maybe who were in the reserves at that time may remember you or your colleagues being recalled to service during the Korean emergency. All right. What happened then is that this enormous surge occurred, this mobilization. And what happens when a country mobilizes is it mobilizes from what it has in place. So you basically have the government you have in place and you simply surge it in every possible direction. That's what happens in a mobilization. You just go. And it goes all over the place. And what happened in those early years is by the summer of 1952, even the Truman administration was realizing that this was almost an incoherent surge. It's just everything was moving, and they wanted to kind of catch their breath, slow down. They could not continue to increase national security spending at that rate. No government could. This needed to level off, and they needed to basically make some hard choices and look at the institutions they had and get ready for the long haul. The Truman administration began addressing that challenge, didn't solve it. It was really the major challenge the Eisenhower administration faced when it took office. And the Eisenhower administration really refined and helped put in place a lot of the institutions and doctrine that defined what we think of as the Cold War, the longstanding doctrines of deterrence, the way we built our strategic nuclear forces, and so on. Eisenhower believed that if we continued to spend money at that rate, it would bankrupt the country. And so you had to smooth this out and get a sustainable program for combating the communist menace that might last for decades. That's the kind of historical moment we're in now. You've had this mobilization. As with any mobilization, like an enormous flood, it's transformed the landscape. Now's the time, and there will always be such a time, whether it's 42 or 43, 52 and 53, or today, when you, after the mobilization has happened, you catch your breath, you take stock, what's working, what's not working, you figure out how much money you can really afford to spend for the long haul, what institutions are working, and you get a strategy in place that will be sustainable. That's the historical moment we are in today. The commission then has perhaps been a vehicle, a catalyst, and helping to define the agenda for that historical moment. Perhaps if there had been no commission, something else would have happened, maybe through the presidential transition from Bush to Bush II or Bush to Kerry. That kind of reflection would have occurred. But the commission happens to have been, a welcome vehicle in many ways to both parties to engage in that kind of reflection. But I wanted you to realize what kind of historical moment you're living in right now. And that moment is not yet complete. The contours of that strategy have not been fleshed out and decided. Staying with this introduction about the generational challenge, part of that challenge is, what is the threat anyway? What the commission said is that we're in a new era of world politics. Possibly the most important change in world politics in centuries, but certainly in 100 years. That is, a fundamental notion of world politics as about international rivalries between blocks of states orienting around global balance of power, in which you're trying to maintain a balance of the great industrial heartlands of the world. That kind of thinking about geopolitics has basically passed with the end of the Cold War, which was the end of the great climactic struggle of the 20th century over to how to organize industrial societies, politically, socially, economically. That means that we live in a world where conflicts and struggles tend to be defined more as transnational problems than as international problems. They are conflicts that cut across societies. They are internal within societies as well as external to them. So, for instance, if you look at a problem like terrorism, that's a transnational problem that we face, the Russians face, the British face, the French face, the Moroccans face. Or environmental degradation, climate change, or HIV/AIDS and infectious diseases. These are transnational problems, or even problems of poverty and alienation, or of a variety of cultural and social issues arising from the telecommunications revolution. These are transnational issues. And fundamentally, the conflicts of this new era tend to be along those battle lines, which are much more complex. Islamist terrorism is especially important as a long-standing transnational challenge because Islamist terrorism arises out of a profound crisis in the Arab and Muslim world, which I talked about in my earlier lecture. That crisis will not be over, did not arise overnight, and it will not be solved overnight. It involves 1 billion people. It involves the coming to terms with modernity of an important fraction of the world's population, which has not really evolved in a way that has allowed them to develop political, social, and economic systems that fully come to grips with modern life. And that process's adaptation has ended up spinning off a distinctively Islamist form of transnational terrorism that can pose unusually great threats to us because of another feature of the new world politics, is dangers can be posed by relatively small organizations and groups. In the 20th century, dangers were defined by weight and mass, literally almost in some ways how much steel they could produce. Large conscript armies built over time, armed over time, deployed, you could see them gather, see them being built, respond to trends. We now live in an age where America can suffer enormous devastating damage from a group of individuals smaller than an army platoon, spending $500,000 to launch their attacks. So that's the kind of threat we face, and that's the kind of world we live in now. What we said, too, in the report is that it is correct, as the Bush administration has said, to call this struggle a war, but we called it more than a war. The vocabulary of war is accurate enough, and in fact, wars are being fought, as in Afghanistan. But it is much more than a war. It is a crisis and a conflict that is also political, social, and economic, as well as involving military and intelligence assets. And so in some ways, the vocabulary of war is limiting, when in fact it's a much broader gauge struggle, as the Cold War was. And the final observation I'll make as an introductory point is about how to measure success. We measure success in these struggles, we say, the goal is to end terrorism. And recently there's been an argument about whether President Bush said, we can't completely eliminate terrorism, you didn't define victory in sufficiently categorical terms. No, no, you, Senator Kerry, you haven't defined victory in sufficiently categorical terms. And I shrugged my shoulders. The goal, it says, we will eliminate terrorism as we know it. Of course, I suppose any presidential candidate has to say that that's what they want. And I think they would all say that they also want to eliminate crime in American cities, have it cease to exist. Meanwhile, while they're working on that, it would be good to set concrete operational objectives. And indeed, when you set non-operational objectives that are abstract, and you portray an enemy that is resilient, adaptable, decentralized, you cut off a head here, it grows another head there, you portray this omnipotent, hydra-headed entity of destruction, and it seems to be unslayable. So you have an abstract goal that cannot be met concretely anytime soon, an unslayable enemy, and people might understandably become a little fatalistic. This is the terrorist enemy is concrete. It is beatable. They have real organizations. Their capabilities can be degraded. Yes, they are resilient and adaptable, but the 9/11 story shows they are also fragile and brittle. They are not 8 feet tall. You can do things that make catastrophic terrorism less likely. You can set concrete operational objectives, and government should not be let off so easily. I believe, actually, that presidents can level with the American people. They can say to them very straight, look, I can't guarantee that we will prevent every act of terrorism. I can't promise that we'll do that. Here's what I can do. I can say we'll do the very best we can. And by doing the very best we can, I say, we will intend to accomplish the following concrete things. And we will run our government in the following concrete ways. And yes, we may miss something, we may get it wrong. But you should judge me by my ability to meet these concrete targets, which are realistic and good targets. And if we do these things, we will be running our government about as well as a government like this can be run against this problem. And if the government is being reasonably well-led, reasonably well-run, I think people will understand that that doesn't mean that you achieve perfection. And I think leaders can level with people, and they are mature enough to understand that. It's a long introduction. Now those three pillars of the global strategy. First, offense. Second one was prevention. And third one was defense. In a way, to think about it in a very simple terms, it's the way you'd combat a malarial epidemic, or in the old days, yellow fever. You want to kill mosquitoes, you want to dry up the swamps, and you want to give people anti-malarial medication, in effect, to harden the targets. Attack terrorists and their organizations. A couple of key things I'll just single out here, and then if you're interested, we can pursue them more in questions. First is big lesson from the 9/11 story. No sanctuaries. No sanctuaries. The 9/11 story tells you what happens if you just leave the terrorists alone with base areas to train, recruit, vet, plan at their leisure. Extremely bad things can happen. Now, here's why this policy is so hard. Where do they go to hide? Where do they choose as their sanctuaries? No, not the great industrial heartlands of the world that used to be the great focal points of geopolitics in the 20th century. They retreat for their sanctuaries to the farthest off places, the least hospitable areas. In other words, they go to the wilderness areas of the world. Therefore, they challenge us to extend our power to the farthest reaches of the known world. That is an extraordinary challenge to any country. Chase us into the jungles of the southern of Mindanao or the southern Luzon. Chase us into you know, the slums of Karachi, chase us into, you know, the desert of North Yemen, chase us into the Horn of Africa or to sub-Saharan West Africa. See if your power extends there. And of course, no one country's power can extend to all these places, which has other implications. The second thing we say, aside from the no sanctuaries point, which is absolutely vital, you have to keep them on the run, keep them hiding. It is hard to plan and launch complex international operations when you're running from cave to cave or from hideout to hideout. The second big point I'll leave you with about attacking terrorists and their organizations is this has particular importance for some specific countries. And we spent a little bit of time especially on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. On Pakistan, we basically said problematical country, but if its leaders are willing to basically put their lives on the line in working with us, then we need to step up reciprocally and respond to that. And finally, President Musharraf, who has a very checkered past when it comes to these issues, has made those kinds of commitments and has literally put his life on the line. And then that involves reciprocal obligations for us. Second, on Afghanistan, we swallowed really hard and said we need to step up to the problem of securing Afghanistan, not just the narrow function of using it as a platform from which to chase terrorists in southern Afghanistan or eastern Afghanistan, but actually take on the broader problems of Afghan stability, a heavy load, one which we should not shoulder alone. NATO is currently arguing, even as we speak in Romania, about whether or not they'll do their job in stepping up to help us, which they have not done yet. But I'm afraid the security and stability of Afghanistan is something we cannot ignore. And I say that with reluctance because it's a faraway place and a forbidding set of problems, especially in narco trafficking. And then third, on Saudi Arabia. On Saudi Arabia, we basically said this is a policy that's existed behind closed doors, this kind of deal of oil for security. And what happens is that no American politician will defend the relationship in public, and no Saudi politician will defend the relationship in public. And such a relationship will not long flourish. Therefore, you have to put the relationship on a basis that politicians in both countries are prepared to defend in public. That means it has to be about something more than simply an oil security trade-off. It has to mean that America is committed to a better future for Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi leadership is also committed to a better and more viable future. It doesn't mean that we have to repudiate everything about Saudi society, which is an extremely religiously conservative society. Then again, there are some people in Europe who think our society is religiously conservative. Now, theirs goes a good deal further than ours. It's an extremely devout country, and it's easy to find things about it to condemn. The judgment of exactly how Saudi Arabia needs to change and adapt to the modern world is ultimately one that the Saudis will need to make. But if they really commit themselves to a serious agenda of reform and change and try to step up to those problems, America has to work with them, and that's something that you can defend publicly. The second pillar of the global strategy is to prevent the continued growth of Islamist terrorism. Here we touched on at least six important ideas, which I'll just flag briefly. First, you have to engage the struggle of ideas. You have to have a vision for the future. Second, you have to have an agenda of opportunity. How can your society in the Arab and Muslim world adapt to modernity and thrive? You have to have an agenda for that. It has to be an agenda that involves things like education and free enterprise, including access to global markets, trade. Actually, the administration's initiative for a Middle East free trade area is enormously important. In the bilateral free trade agreements they've now done with Morocco and Jordan and are moving forward on with Bahrain are very significant, though little noticed, efforts. Third, you need to turn a national counterterrorism strategy into a coalition strategy. This does not mean that the caricature is true that the Bush administration doesn't work with foreigners, unilateral versus multilateral. They work with foreigners all the time. They work with foreigners in a way so much that it's incomprehensibly complex. They have networks of bilateral relationships in every possible direction among almost every major federal agency now, because of these transnational problems. You have border agency to border agency, police agency to police agency, intelligence agency to intelligence agency, including, of course, the usual diplomats and soldiers. So there's a lot of foreign activity. That does not mean you have a coalition strategy. It does not mean you have institutions for managing a coalition strategy. So in other words, all these ad hoc bilateral relationships need to be regularized, routinized into regular habits of multilateral cooperation, which have not yet been developed and need to be developed. We are articulating national strategies. We have not yet joined with our key partners, including Muslim partners, to articulate coalition strategies. And one of the elements of articulating a coalition strategy is an agreed approach on how to handle captured terrorists and detainees, where our unilateral national approach has manifestly failed. Fourth, we need to act on weapons of mass destruction and proliferation vigorously. The administration is acting vigorously. It can do even more. I think it is aware of that and actually has endorsed some ideas for moving actively on that. That itself is is a matter that could be covered in two or three lectures of its own. I just simply want to flag that that's a critical parallel issue. Fifth is terrorist money. One of the big lessons we learned about terrorist money is that you can't dry up terrorist access to money. It's like trying to catch fish by drying up the ocean. It's inefficient. What you can, however, do is look at terrorist money as a critical intelligence tool. If you follow the money, you can get insights that allow you to attack terrorist organizations in powerful ways. And that's something that's turned out to be very effective. The initial hopes that you could dry up the pond haven't worked out. The intelligence approach to terrorist money has. Let me stop there on the second pillar of prevention and turn to the third pillar of protection. Here, again, we singled out five important ideas. First, you got to protect yourself by thinking hard about how people travel. One of the major revelations of the 9/11 report was to spotlight the importance of terrorist travel, which we said is more important than terrorist money. You will get more powerful results by targeting their travel than you will by targeting their money, because they spend enormous amount of time working on their travel problems. Because for them, they're like the submariner who, when they travel, that's the moment in which they surface and sail right in front of the naval base at Gibraltar before they can submerge again in the open ocean. See, they have to actually get up out of their hideouts, present themselves to government officials face to face repeatedly, showing them identification, until they can get through all those little channels they have to run through and then can submerge again. It's in a period of extraordinary vulnerability for them, and they know it, and that's why they devote so much energy to gaming and working travel problems. And to work internationally, you've got to travel. And in fact, the more we attack their communications, the more they have to travel to communicate, using couriers, for example, actually using couriers to transmit money. So terrorist travel is very powerful, and there's a lot more that we could do in targeting terrorist travel, which we articulate in the report. For instance, turn passports into 21st century documents that are at least as well protected as credit cards, as opposed to the 18th and 19th century documents that fundamentally they still are. Second, under prevention and protection, that means we need a whole different architecture for screening people. One of the things about a risky society is you get screened and checked when you do things, when you go into a nuclear reactor facility, when you board an airplane, when you apply for a visa. You're being screened and checked. And what's happening is all those screening, all those checkpoints are all being done on their own. Every agency is inventing its own procedures for doing this. Instead of seeing this as a system in which people flow through the system and you develop an architecture of systems, that is, at what point will we demand what kind of identification, which will be checked against what kind of reference database, with what kinds of procedures for what we do if there's a hit, and then how you get off those lists too. Because the answers to those questions are not the same at every point in that checkpoint. The time you can take in processing someone when they apply for a visa is totally different from the time you can take in processing them when they're standing drumming their fingers at the airport gate. So there are example after example of how you need to think about an architecture in approaching this problem of screening instead of doing this agency by agency. And we call for that. And actually, the president, in response to our recommendation, put forward a significant presidential directive on this subject at the end of August. Third, under protection, aviation and transportation security. To give you an example, since 9/11, we've devoted billions of dollars to problems of aviation and transportation security, overwhelmingly focused on winning the last war. 90 to 95% of all TSA spending is on aviation security. And actually, the overwhelming majority of that is on passenger aviation security. But what about general aviation security, cargo aviation security? What about rail security, maritime security? Not enough being done there, and actually there are some problems in aviation security, although there have been significant improvements. Fourth, civil liberties. We call for a lot of efforts to think comprehensively about how people are screened, about how their documents are obtained, about the quality of their personal identification. This implies a greater presence of government in people's lives, in day-to-day sense. Therefore, you have to offset that with conscious attention to civil liberties and with checks and balances that offset those increments in governmental power. We do live in a more risky society. That will mean some changes in the way you think about the role of government. But therefore, you need to respond to those incremental changes with efforts that counterbalance those intrusions with checks to preserve our civil liberties. And we make some recommendations on that score. And finally, we call for a different approach to emergency preparedness and first response, both in the public and private sector, in a variety of specific ways, informed by our analysis of the New York story, especially. Let me finally and briefly now turn to the second half of our approach to our recommendations, which are government organization. I'm going to spend less time on this, frankly, because that's where all the public attention has been. I wanted to spend the vast majority of the time on the substance and the strategy because you've heard much less about it. On government organization, though, there were about seven different things we called for, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each of them, but I'll touch on a little bit. The fundamental theme, though, in all of our recommendations for government organization is this: unity of effort. Unity of effort. We have a big government. We are spending about as much money in a broad sense on national security probably as the country can afford to spend. Now, of course, if we had to in a catastrophic emergency spend more, we could. But for the long haul, the kind of levels of spending and levels of resource commitment we now have to national security are probably approximately about what the country can pay for, given our general fiscal situation. That means we have to more or less, within these levels of resource commitment we have now, make our institutions as effective as possible. There's this enormous outpouring of effort. What's needed above all right now is to coordinate and get the synergies of all that expenditure, that $550 billion. That requires unity of effort. First, to unify intelligence and planning against terrorism across the foreign domestic divide. In my first talk, I talked about how the operational management had broken down, how there was no attending physician for the entering patients. Those kinds of operational management weaknesses, the failure to fuse intelligence, the failure to jointly plan operations, has to be addressed. That's why we called for creation of a National Counterterrorism Center. This National Counterterrorism Center sounds like, oh, okay, they call for creation of a new agency. It's actually a much bigger innovation than that. It's actually profound innovation in the way our government works. It's effectively a prototype for changing the way our government works. Our government is organized according to the finest management principles of 1950. We have these large, vertically integrated industrial behemoths, Alfred Sloan's General Motors, if you will. And what they have done in the private sector now for a generation is adopt matrix organization concepts for large organizations. A matrix organization basically has thin horizontal integration in the front office across the big operating divisions in order to get some synergy there. That's the model of organization you see at Citicorp, at General Electric, at IBM, TRW, and so on. The government hasn't picked up on this at all, with the one partial exception of actually the American military, which has military departments that organize, train, and equip units for combat. But then those same units, when they go into combat, are commanded by unified or specified commands, a different chain of command. And then there is a joint staff that runs across all the services and all the unified commands that does joint intelligence and operational planning in both those streams, both the unified commands and the military departments. But it's not part of the chain of command of either. If that sounds complex, it is. But it works. It sure works better than what they had before Goldwater Nichols and what they had before they created a Secretary of Defense after World War II. I don't find anyone longingly calling for a return of the armed forces to the good organization they had in the 1970s. Ironically, it's the most complex, and if you ask people in DOD, they earnestly insist, yes, we believe in complete unity of command. So they portray it in the most simplistic ways, and in fact, it's the most complex. We call, in effect, this National Counterterrorism Center is a joint staff, a joint intelligence and joint operational planning staff that cuts across the executive departments. Nothing like this exists in the federal government. The National Security Council, which is relied on now to get agencies to cooperate with each other, is like, in a way, asking the board of directors to solve the joint operational planning issues of General Electric. The National Security Council is supposed to work on advising the president on big policy. It's not designed to do day-to-day operational management across the operating divisions, and it doesn't do it very well, although it, too, has increased enormously in size. So the first big thing about unity of effort is to unify intelligence and planning against counterterrorism, which has stressed our government like no other problem has. Second, we need to unify management of the intelligence community with a new national intelligence director. The intelligence community, for those of you who have not studied it, and mastering the intelligence community is more or less analogous to the historians who are masters of the 17th century Habsburg Empire. You know, the people who are really experts in how the Holy Roman Empire worked. They're very proud of that knowledge once they've acquired it. Very few people can acquire it. And the intelligence community experts are like that. I speak from experience. And there's kind of a jealous pride. It says, no, don't restructure the Holy Roman Empire. I got it. I can work it. It needs fixing. There's been a lot of argument about this. I won't get into all of it. The big misunderstanding about this recommendation is fundamentally it's an enabler. There are 40 different things that need to be done within CIA, within NSA, increasing collection of human intelligence, increasing the way, adapting the way we do signals intelligence, changing the way we do intelligence analysis, and so on and so on. Rather than try to micromanage the community by getting into every one of those things they should do, hey, let's first of all restructure it so that at least it can be managed. Because right now, the people who are in charge of managing it cannot hire and fire the heads of their operating divisions. And they don't have control over 85% of the intelligence community budget. Now, which of you as managers in the private sector would accept serious management responsibilities for an organization over which you had neither personnel nor budgetary authority? Third, unity of effort in sharing information. We have a government that fundamentally handles information on a hub-and-spoke mainframe concept. These are concepts that would be familiar to any of you from your experience in, say, 1965. What we have, of course, now in outside of government is a world of distributed network capacity, where the real power of the network is at the edges of the network. It's the power of distributed PCs, not the power of your mainframe. We don't have that kind of, we haven't harnessed that kind of power in our government yet. To build those network capabilities is something no one agency can do, of course. No one member of the network can build the network. That's why it requires a national effort, and it hasn't happened yet, and that's something that needs to be done. Briefly, the others are unity of effort in the Congress, where we found congressional oversight and its policy guidance was profoundly dysfunctional. This is an agenda Congress has not embraced yet with enthusiasm. Frankly, they think that they broke so much crockery in getting some of our other stuff through, especially in the Senate, that they could not go this additional mile. Fifth, on the FBI, we called for trying to institutionalize the reforms that are currently underway in the FBI. Importantly, we did not call for scrapping the FBI's role. We did not call for creation of a new domestic intelligence agency. A lot of people were pressing that on us, and we looked hard at it and decided, in fact, that was a bad idea. That the FBI has capabilities to do this job if it can properly be transformed. You don't want to have to reinvent those organizational capacities from scratch if it can be changed. And Mueller gets the problem and is trying to change it, to his credit. And what we wanted to do is reinforce that and institutionalize it so that to try to avoid backsliding. Sixth, we talked about presidential transitions in the personnel process, because in this modern age, we don't think an administration should be effectively headless for 5 or 6 months while Congress works through its processes of trying to give the senior people in place some subordinates to work with, which is what happened in early 2001. It's basically most of the senior officials in the government weren't in place for the first 6 months, which turned out in retrospect to be an important time. And seventh and finally, to rationalize the way we think about homeland defense. We are in a situation now where we have new roles for federal government in defending the homeland. The Department of Homeland Security is now deeply involved in interacting with local communities and state authorities. The Department of Defense now has created a new unified command for defending the homeland from attack in ways that would only be familiar to Thomas Jefferson, but not familiar to any recent presidents. We need to think hard about what is the role of the Department of Defense inside America, and how does that relate to the role of the Department of Homeland Security. So now step back. This is an ambitious agenda, if you think about it as a whole. Some of it is directly congruent to the 9/11 story, some not. But someone was asking me, says, well, you were calling for some of these things, and can you show me exactly how each one of these ideas would have prevented 9/11? And I said, well, that's not really the approach we took. This is the approach of, after investigating Pearl Harbor, you would then have a recommendation saying, recommendation number three, do not group your airplanes on Hickam Field anymore. And that's great. So when the Japanese attack you again in 1950, you're ready. So you've protected America against another Pearl Harbor attack, except that the next attack probably won't be, you know, 19 hijackers on those four flights. In other words, you can't fall into recommendations that simply are, how do I protect Hickam Field better next time? You have to think harder and deeper about what are the fundamental systemic weaknesses of a government that fundamentally was built and designed to win the Cold War, embryonically to win World War II, and then in its full development to win the Cold War, and is now in a different world. The greatest generation changed our government institutions and made radical fixes to adapt to the world they lived in and the challenges they face. The challenges now of this generation are to change the government we have and adopt new strategies on an equal scale of magnitude to adapt to the world they will face. Let me stop there. Questions?
Philip, you said that one of your three pillars was defense. Certainly in this presidential campaign, we're hearing a lot of dialogue back and forth. Senator Kennedy, Kerry last night attacking the president that he had mismanaged since 9/11. But still, the fact that since 9/11, we have not had one incident of terrorism in this country has to be a rather remarkable accomplishment. I'd like to think more of good management than good luck. Do you have a comment on that?
I don't think it is simply luck that we have not been attacked since 9/11. Why do I think that? They wanted to attack us. If they could have attacked us by now, they would. Now, it may be that attack will come this afternoon or tomorrow or in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that sometime between 9/11 and the election of 2004, these organizations would like to have inflicted a catastrophic blow on the United States, actually multiple blows, if they had their druthers. If that does not happen, that will not be a product of luck or their basically their decision that they don't want to do it. So something has happened that has made them less capable of doing it. And whatever that something is good. Now, politicians, including the president, are reluctant to talk this way because, of course, you say something like that and then something happens the next day and you'll seem foolish and complacent. So they politicians just won't say that. There are a few that will, but in general, they tend not to. And I'm reluctant a little bit to get too far out on a limb on this because you don't want to sound complacent because something really awful may happen. We really don't know why we haven't been attacked. It's another part of the problem. We don't know exactly to what it, here's what I think we can safely say. We have degraded the operational capability of Al-Qaeda. We have degraded their capability to plan and launch complex international operations, of which 9/11 was one. The 9/11 operation, if you study it carefully, is not like the Bali nightclub bombing in Indonesia or the Madrid train attack or the attacks in Casablanca or Istanbul. It is an organization with a different kind of plan that's an international operation. It's much more complicated in the movement of people and money than those operations are. Those are essentially decentralized operations carried out by regional entities in the regions where they live. So something has happened that has degraded their capabilities. Of course, the Afghan sanctuary that was the fundamental base area of the organization has been destroyed. They are not completely out of Afghanistan, and they are hiding in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border areas, and left alone could turn that back into a sanctuary area. And I'm especially worried about Western Pakistan more than I am about regions of Afghanistan. But in general, something has happened that has degraded their capabilities. Now, here's the problem is, has it degraded them enough? We don't know. Have they regenerated in a decentralized way where their affiliates are now capable of launching medium scale but also devastating operations? Operations like Madrid or Bali, which could kill hundreds of people and which cumulatively, of course, could be horrifying and difficult. But one of the first challenges we have is, first, let's avoid another 9/11, or worse, because worse is what they would like to do. They are working very hard to get nuclear, biological, radiological, chemical weapons. They've been working hard at this for 10 years. They would like, if they could, to kill millions of Americans. So it's a tough agenda, and have we certainly prevented that? We don't know. But as we said in the report, we are safer, but we are not safe. It's a long-standing problem. And I think even if you took from my remarks a source of optimism, I think none of you would take those remarks as a reason that you could say, oh, well, we're done with this now. I don't have to worry about that anymore. That's the point I was making about long-term vigilance, but also the point I was making about they are not 10 feet tall. You can degrade them. You can make it harder for them to operate. You don't have to be fatalistic about this problem.
Question from one of the overflow rooms. Would you talk more about the recommendations to reduce the causes of terrorism?
Yes, the causes of terrorism, the causes of Islamist terrorism really is the main focus of our recommendations. Terrorism is a generic phenomenon. It is a tactic. We did not look at how to prevent Basque terrorism, Irish terrorism, and so on. We one of the administration's failings is to treat terrorism too much as a generic term and focus less on the specific character of Islamist terrorism, because that does lead you then to really thinking about a preventive political, social, and economic agenda in the Muslim world. And in general, since 9/11, and for understandable reasons, mostly the world has seen the face of American anger. And instead, they need to see the face of American hope. This is, by the way, where we have an enormous advantage over Osama bin Laden. Because look at this from the perspective of the Arab and Muslim parent, the mom and dad, who mostly, like all parents, want a better world for their children. What is the better world that Osama bin Laden offers? The world of the apocalypse, of unending violence, and the promise of religious paradise. America can beat that. We can promise a better future for their children in a way he cannot. He has no agenda of hope, opportunity, or greater prosperity for these countries. America can help articulate that agenda in partnership with those countries. I emphasize in partnership with them, because frankly, if it is seen as an American agenda, it will be legitimized, delegitimized precisely because we are its carrier, because America right now has been so profoundly demonized throughout the Arab and Muslim world.
Sir, please wait for the microphone there.
I wonder if you'd comment about the Homeland Security Department, which it was my understanding, at least, that this was a combination of all of the various government agencies. Why has the cost increased so much?
Well, because we're actually getting all those agencies to do more than they did before. They weren't doing enough before. We created a Transportation Security Administration, which didn't exist. We are trying to do things in searching cargo and freight in ways that we never dreamed of before. We're increasing our border security and the size of the border patrol in a variety of ways and so on. So the underlying efforts are in every one of those components are larger than they used to be, this sense of mobilization. There is also, by the way, lots of money is simply flowing from the federal government to states and localities to build up their own emergency assistance programs. Money that, some of it is extremely well spent, some of it is not. A lot of it is being used as a general revenue sharing program and pork barrel. We were harshly critical of that in the commission report and said that all that spending needs to be allocated according to risk. That's politically difficult. So the results are, there was a good story in the front page of the New York Times, I think 2 days ago, about how people in Alaska have gotten millions of dollars from the federal government for emergency readiness in rural Alaska. And it gets really rural in rural Alaska. And there's a story about how these people, you know, near the Arctic Circle are scratching their heads. How can we spend this $2 million? We really need to think of something. There are people in New York City who could give them some advice on how that money could be used.
How important are congressional oversight committees? Will they consent to reducing their numbers?
They have not so far. Congressional oversight committees are really important. And actually, they were not as important in the pre-9/11 story as they should have been, because mostly, tended not to do their job. Here's what they tend to do. They tend to they tend to be highly reactive to the political issue of the day and hold hearings on whatever that is. They tend to be very interested in the macro budget. And what happens is, because they're overwhelmingly interested in budget, their staff then tends to micromanage 100 different things, most of which they can't really do very well. What they really don't provide is substantive policy oversight, day in and day out, on what the priorities should be, on the way things need to change. And we were very critical of Congress. Now, partly that's because oversight responsibility is diffuse, and therefore accountability for these matters is broken up and diffuse. In the case of Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security is practically being destroyed by congressional oversight. The Department of Homeland Security reports and testifies to 88 congressional committees and subcommittees. They spend massive amounts of time simply testifying to all these overseers, and they're polled, therefore, in a dozen different directions. The House of Representatives, to its credit, actually created a select Homeland Security Committee, while, of course, none of the other committees, like Judiciary and so on, surrendered their jurisdiction. The Senate has not even done that, although the current Senate reform, provoked perhaps by our recommendations that they adopted last week, would turn the Governmental Affairs Committee in the Senate into a Homeland Security Committee. And the House is planning some similar things. So they have some modest things that they're trying to do to make that system a little bit better. We wanted to go much further. We wanted a clear, powerful center of oversight that had lots of clout and therefore lots of accountability. And we therefore called either for a joint intelligence committee of both houses on the model of the old Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, or for concentrating authorization and appropriations responsibility in one committee in both houses. For those of you who don't understand what I mean by this, what I mean is one committee in the Senate authorizes a budget, another committee in the Senate actually appropriates it. Guess which committee the agencies tend to spend more time with? And in fact, it's worse than that in the intelligence case, because right now, one committee authorizes it for the intelligence community, then that is completely rewritten by the Armed Services Committee because it's all being put into the defense budget in order to hide it, and because so much of it belongs to the Defense Department anyway. And then after it goes there, it goes to an appropriations committee, and on the appropriations committee, it goes to its defense subcommittee. We thought that system needed to be changed. The relevant committee chairman did not agree, except on the Intelligence Committee, who enthusiastically agreed.
Sir? I'm wondering how the non-Muslim world can improve the way we relate personally to the Muslim world.
Well, one start to that is we should try to develop some institution where the non-Muslim world and the Muslim world talk to each other, other than the United Nations. We don't really have that now. The Muslim world has basically caucuses where they talk to themselves, like the Organization of the Islamic Conference. The West has, of course, things like the G8, NATO, the European Union, and so on. But there, and even the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But there's no multilateral institution where they get together. Now, a good start was made actually at the G8 summit this past summer at Sea Island in South Carolina, where they began creating a new forum for Western countries and Muslim countries to talk about issues like political reform. And that's gotten off to a halting start, but there are some signs of promise there. We think that needs to go much further. Because in theory, you could develop a whole agenda for reform that includes channeling development assistance to promising countries where it will do the most good. And you could almost turn that institution into a steering committee that would help identify those countries and channel, pool and channel multilateral assistance that cumulatively could amount to a lot of money. That could be important. Those kinds of institutions haven't been built yet. We'd like to create habits of discussion across the Christian-Muslim divide. I see. For humanity, or
something.
Track two efforts, what they call. Yeah, first, it's great, and I'm all for it. Kind of anything that build. Who can be against building mutual understanding? I can't. I will, however, comment that mutual understanding has its limits. The architect of the 9/11 attack went to college in North Carolina. That's where he got his degree in mechanical engineering. Thank goodness he's not a UVA alum. When they were casting around for someone who could design biological weapons for them, they scratched their head and finally found an operative out of Southeast Asia who moved to Kandahar and began building an anthrax lab for them in Kandahar because he'd been trained in microbiology by the University of California system. So there are examples, I'm afraid, of people who've spent plenty of time in America and have had a lot of opportunities to build mutual understanding, and it didn't pan out. Of course, the core cell of hijackers were people who basically came together living in the West. So I'm all for mutual understanding, but with an asterisk.
We have time for one last question. The gentleman here.
Could you discuss if there's any ongoing role of the staff or the committee in lobbying the government and Congress for the implementation of your recommendations?
Well, since the Congress has called their legislation things like the, as to quote the House bill, the 9/11 Commission Implementation Act, you might imagine they would occasionally ask us what we think of their act. And they have. And so they ask us for our views and advice. We're trying to carry out your recommendations. Is this what you meant? Is this what you had in mind? How did you work through this issue? And we've been very responsive to those sorts of questions in both the Senate and the House, and with both sides of the aisle. And I've personally been very involved in that. The 9/11 Commission no longer exists. It's a federal agency. It's gone out of existence. The commissioners raised money to create a very small nonprofit organization, the 9/11 Public Discourse Project, to kind of keep the lamp burning. It is staffed by three or four of our former staffers in Washington, not by me. I'm not an employee of that entity and receive nothing from them in the way of salary, or I'm not paid for my time. But the commissioners are board members of that, and they help arrange commissioners' public appearances and provide an educational function. But because of their tax status as a nonprofit, they cannot directly lobby Congress. They can provide only an educational function. Since I'm not an employee of that organization, I am not so constrained.
Behind every successful man, there is a surprised mother-in-law, and the daughter of the... I think as we thank Philip for not only the extraordinary review of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission that he's given us here, but also for his public service, we should also recognize the sacrifice that Paige Zellico and their children have made as a result of Philip's service. But thank you very much.